Well, I didn't really think Tesla would be successful. I thought we would most likely fail.
When you give more people a voice that makes the world better, then we have a lot of reasons to be optimistic about the future.
Immediately, when you look at products, it's not just about how do they look, how do they feel, when are they shipping, it's how are they built.
Stay hungry, stay foolish.
So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Barry Flanagan, founder of IOL Ireland Online, the originator of bringing the whole of Ireland online back in 1992. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Thank you very much, Ed.
So we'd love to hear your story, because it's a really interesting story back to your early years and you're actually coming back to Ireland and your travels overseas, etc. Could you tell us a bit about the background of Barry Flanagan?
I'll do my best to keep it short. I was born in Canada of classic Irish immigrant parents who left Ireland. My father from the UK, my mother from Ireland, in the 50s to go to Canada to make a new life for themselves. And they had myself and two elder sisters. And we tended to travel a lot within North America because of my father's work in development. And had, if you've ever seen The Wonder Years, that old series, which was set in the early 1970s America, that was my childhood. It was really idyllic, riding bikes all the time, freedom. I remember hippies in the park and, played tennis and did all those things until when I was 13, my father was competing in a transatlantic solo yacht race that took place this year, every 4 years from Plymouth in England to Newport in Rhode Island. And unfortunately, his boat was found in mid-Atlantic and some body never found. But that was really the end of my childhood, as it was. And shortly after that, it was just now my mother and my two sisters in living in Connecticut at the time. My mother didn't really feel it was the best position to be in, to being a widow, bringing up three budding teenagers in America. And she had a lot of pressure from her brothers and sisters to move us all back to the relative safety of Ireland. Which we duly did. My mother had been brought up in Derry, but because the Troubles were still going on in the North, she didn't want to live in Northern Ireland and yet didn't want to be too far from her family. So Donegal, just on Lough Swilly, was the choice, which was a lovely place. I still enjoyed sailing and did a great deal of that. Unfortunately, my mother then passed away. She had cancer and really never really got over my father's. I can imagine that, to lose a husband like that must have been quite hard to deal with. And so she then subsequently died. And that left us kind of, I was 16, my sisters had just turned 18. And so we were, really it was up to us to work out life and how we were going to navigate it. And I suppose that given the varied and not average kind of upbringing that we had had, I had a different view of what the world was and life than possibly other 16-year-olds did. And so really, I felt at this stage that, right, well, my life, I'm responsible for it, and nobody else is going to see to me. And with that in mind, I, being a brash and somewhat precocious 16-year-old, decided that the education that I was receiving in in the formal school environment wasn't really what I needed or wanted. It was also very difficult, you know, being 16, and later when I was 17, I was actually living on my own. To be living an adult life at home and then to go into school and to be treated like a child. So there was a bit of, you know, friction in that. And so I decided that really I would take responsibility for my own education. So I, you know, kind of left school. And I say kind of because I was actually getting U.S. Social Security from that my father had paid, and as long as I was in full-time education. And also the school that I went to, for 50 cents a day, you got a hot lunch made for you. And at lunchtime, they used to take the rolls. So I would go in, have lunch, get my name taken as being present. And if there was a class that I had an interest in, some of the physics classes I went to, some of the history. Thinking back, it was really the teachers that I was going to, the few teachers that actually seemed to have a passion for their subject. And then I'd go home and do my own thing. And my own thing at that stage was I had done well in the science things, and school tried to push me into, oh, you're going to be a chemist or a biologist, or but my own interests were actually, you know, in history and literature and lots of other areas. In the couple of years after leaving school, I probably read, you know, most of the classics, the you know, histories and all of that, and dabbled in the physics and the science things, and eventually then I did a lot of going out and partying. I remember on the first day I'd gone to school in Derry. So it was O levels and A levels rather than leaving cert. On the first day of my A level year, I remember passing the school on my way to, or sorry, it was my O level year, passing the school on my way to into the music shop to buy a guitar, and then walking back past the school with the guitar over my shoulder, and went home. So learned a bit of guitar played and all of that. Went to all the festivals during the summer, you know, had a good free time, but was always reading and writing and just doing things and looking about myself. I think there was what character from literature, one of Dickens's characters, I think, who would look about himself.
Looking for experiences and
yeah, seeking just out seeing the lay of the land and you know what my interests were. I've always been somebody I'm passionate about things. You know, I don't just half do something. If I'm going to do it, I actually get into it and get stuck in. It used to drive my sister mad, you know, when she'd discover that her radio was missing. And, you know, taking it apart. And, you know, it wasn't a radio anymore. It was part of something else.
But that passion, I mean, it's interesting you say about the teachers, and I don't know if you've realized this yourself, but you were, those teachers resonated or connected with you because they were passionate about their subject.
Yeah.
That's how you seem to be as well. When you get into something, you go for it 100%. And, you know, when we talked before the show, you mentioned about, you know, you feel you've not really worked a day in your life because you've always gone after your passions, and, you know, the money will follow those kind of passions.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know if you've
ever passion is the most important thing that a person can have. Mm. You know, if you have a passion, if a child has a passion for something, let them do it, encourage them to do it, because there's no more fulfilled person than one who is given the freedom and knows in their mind that they are able to follow what interests them. And at the end of the day, you know, it's a long life of working one way or another. You know, everybody has to do something, and to do something that you're passionate about is a gift.
Yeah. And it's almost like, I mean, thinking about what you were saying about looking about yourself, it's almost like what your role is as a parent as well. It's you're bringing a sampling tray to your children, and you're kind of going, what do you like here? Here's the hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah, sometimes.
And they go, I like pesto. Let's go for pesto then. You be an expert in pesto making.
Yeah.
And it's almost a bit of that as well. And so let's fast forward then to IOL. So what it really seems like you're traveling, your experiences really put into a mixing bowl, and it gave you a different lens through which you see the world.
Mm.
And then you spotted this opportunity. When did you spot the opportunity for Ireland Online?
Well, after school, I got married quite young, and we were still living in Donegal. And just to digress for a moment, because it is relevant. And I had young children, and suddenly, so now, you know, I was 19, had a baby girl. And suddenly your whole perspective changed, because it was no longer now just me that I was responsible for. I was now responsible for somebody else. And there was this panic then of, oh no, I need a trade. You know, I can't, whatever about me following my instincts when it was only myself, once I had a wife and child that I had to consider, I became very uptight and was, you know, at the time the training ANCO which was a forebear to the industrial training people. And I looked at, you know, getting a trade as a plumber. I'm a great believer in a trade. You know, I think that if you can make something, if you can fix something, that is a way that you can earn a crust, so that for, you know, a year or two was less than that actually was what I considered. Right, you know, will I do this? And then as I looked at it and I thought about, you know, really is this going to sustain me? You know, in myself. And it became clear that it wasn't. And I thought, okay, perhaps architecture, which would encompass both my artistic inclination and my more classical scientific side, because the corners have to fit and you've got angles and all the rest, but it also has to look beautiful. I looked at that and it was... you know, I'd have to go and do a leaving cert or whatever, and then 6 years to train as an architect. And then when you get out of architecture, if you're lucky, you're going making somebody else's drawings for 10 years. And the reality of that actually didn't fit either, because, no, I didn't want to be a draftsman for somebody else. You know, I want to be the conductor of the orchestra. And so I decided then that rather than... invest what money I had in 6 years of college with who knows what outcome, that I would instead set up a business, and that surely the running of that business would teach me more actual life skills than the architecture. And who knows, after 6 years, I may have a business there that actually works, or I'll have a great deal of experience that I can use in other places. So I set up a sailing and windsurfing school and a retail shop in Donegal, Swilly Marine, it was called, on the shores of Loch Swilly. And anyway, long story short, ran that for 83 to 88, so 5 years. Five very wet years where we didn't have a summer in the whole of Ireland, whatever about Donegal, which rarely has summers. But I would do that during the summer, and in the winter I did things like I fixed boilers, oil-fired boilers, because I could and nobody else wanted to do it because your hands get really very dirty. So I'd, you know, had a whatever a couple of dozen people that I just went fix their boilers, and we did bed and breakfast as well during the summer. So anyway, when we decided, right, that that wasn't going to happen in Donegal, we then moved to London, and I spent, we didn't move. I left in February. February in Donegal is the worst month. It's when you know, if you get past February, you know you're good for another year, because by that stage, the winter has just taken its toll. And I went over to London initially, working with a temping agency that was absolutely wonderful, in that 1 week I'd be working in the Tower Hotel in the kitchens as a commis chef. The next week I'd be driving a delivery van around London. The next week I'd be working in the back door of the hotel where all the goods come in and out. That was an education. And I did that for about 6 months until, as it happened, my uncle, who was a very, at this stage, he wasn't actually very well known. He was just becoming well known. Sculptor, works in bronze. A lot of the hairs and stuff, you'll see them up at IMA and New York and everywhere else you go. He was living in Ibiza at the time, and came back to London. And we met up, and he was, you know, glad to see me. And, oh, you're in London. He said, well, he says, you know, my practice is getting larger. I could use some help. So I jumped at that. So that's fantastic. Now, making bronze sculptures, there's quite a lot to it, because you've got, and he was doing them on an architectural scale, quite large pieces at this stage. And, you know, they're modeled in clay on steel armatures. And then the bronze foundry, which is a very industrial process, takes those, makes molds, and then ultimately creates a bronze replica or replicas of these. So I slotted in by kind of being the go-between between Barry, who just wanted to, he's Barry Flanagan also. He wanted to make sculpture. He didn't want to actually have, you know, deal too much with the foundries. Although he did interact a lot with them, but the actual, you know, paperwork and logistical stuff. So I took on that role and did all that. And as part of that, because he was living in Ibiza and we were going to New York and, you know, on the continent quite frequently, and I was also running all of the finances and NatWest Bank in 1989, I think, released what they called modem banking, which was that with the computer, with the modem, they had a program that you could load and you could actually, you know, transfer, like Banking 365 now, except it was, you know, it was very early. And this was a godsend, because we had, you know, there was a lot of money having to be transferred, you know, to pay for casting and then when pieces were sold and all of that. And this enabled me to basically dial in from wherever I was in the world and keep this together. I thought, this is great. Like, this really frees me from even being in London, that I could, you know, spend 2 weeks in Ibiza. Tough, you know, it's tough. yet still keep on top of things. And I thought about that more. And we also, by this stage, had a secretary based in London, just, you know, answering letters and doing that kind of stuff. And so I bought her a PC and I put a modem into that and ran a little program so that now I could dial the bank to do the banking, but I could also dial in and connect to this computer in London, and I could upload a file that she would then print and do whatever. So great, you know, I'm like totally free from being anywhere. And then I got, you know, this idea of connecting a computer to a phone line to enable you to connect to other people and to, you know, to do things that are location independent really took my fancy. I like the whole idea of it, this mix of the, you know, technology thing of taking things apart and putting them back together and connecting things up. And so that kind of progressed over the time that I was working with Barry, using bulletin board systems and that type of thing, and discovering, you know, you could be talking to somebody in chatting, like text chatting, in Arizona or different places around the world, and this just kept, you know, there's something here, there's definitely something here. You know, coming from my immigrant parents, right, who left Ireland because of a lack of opportunity, and seeing this technology that, wow, you know, if this was available, people wouldn't have to leave Ireland anymore. You know, they could still work on a global scale and communicate on a global scale and live in Ireland. And that to me was like the best combination that you could possibly have. So in 1991, decided the kids now were getting old. We'd never really intended to, you know, bring up children in London for a very long period of time. We wanted to have the experience and stuff, but, you know, once they start getting into secondary school, you need a bit more stability in school. And so we decided to move back to Galway, and my my feeling was that this could be made to work in Ireland. I didn't want to do it in Dublin, even though I knew, and I said before doing this, you know, we could go and live in Dublin, and I could do this out of my back bedroom and immediately have a million odd people within the local, because it was all dial up, so you had to actually make a local call, which in those days still costs an exorbitant amount of money. But my whole point of the thing was not just that you could live in Ireland and yet work globally, but that you can live in Galway instead of Dublin. And so I was, you know, still idealistic, something I've never, still haven't been cured from. hasn't done me, you know, a whole lot of good, but I actually probably wouldn't change it either, because it makes life much more fun. So I set up, I didn't know anything about anything. Like, I had left school, I had no formal training. I had, back in 1992 or three, decided that computers at that stage, the Commodore 64 and all of those, were just coming out, the ZX Spectrum and stuff. And I decided that that's something that I should get my head around. So I bought a Dragon 32, which is very like a Commodore, basic, literally and figuratively, basic computer that you plugged into a TV set and you could load programs using an old cassette recorder that you had to listen
had
to.
The squelch.
Yeah. Oh, did you? Right. Yeah. And so I got that and, you know, made a clock and did some other things, and enough that I said, right, I get that. Like, I understand what they are. And later then, when I set up Swilly Marine, a very good friend bought me an Amstrad CPM machine, affectionately known as Joyce, was the one. It was a couple of floppy disks for memory, but it was a word processor, and you could get accounts packages for it. And so with Swilly Marine, I used that then. And so now I was actually applying computers to something. So then by the time I was working with Barry, you know, I had a rudimentary knowledge of computers. But when I landed back in Galway, I had a vision that you can connect people together using computers, and it's not just about connecting computers, it's about connecting the people behind the computers, and that if you can do that, that it changes the ballgame for Ireland completely. And for me personally, because I could then live in Ireland. But I hadn't a notion how to do it. So I set about figuring out how am I going to do this. And you know, I've said previously about, you know, I was always a voracious reader of history and novels and all the rest. Well, that all stopped. I then began reading manuals from cover to cover, and I read them and actually began to appreciate them as being equally inventive and magnificent as your great, you know, literature, because it's all the invention of the human mind. This is something, computers are something that man just literally made out of nothing, just by applying thought to something. And in that vein, I was able, and I still am, I've recently started reading novels again, but so I, maybe I'm better, but I would literally be able to read a manual from cover to cover and just suck it all in, and then fit the bits together, you know, so that you knew where to reference, to put 2 + 2 and to make it something. So that's what I did for probably 6 months. In late 91, 92, just looking, how can I do this? I set up a bulletin board system, the old BBS precursor to the internet or anything, on a couple of phone lines. That didn't really get me where I needed to be, because in order for this to work, it literally had to be global. And then at the end of 1991, the National Science Foundation in the US, the NSF, announced the internet had existed as a purely academic network, academic and military. And it was used to connect up universities and research facilities and that type of thing, and designed to withstand a nuclear war. So it was very robust. But the internet, the NFS, ran the internet backbone in the US, which was the main optic cables and whatever that connected the internet. And up until the end of 1991, that was purely academic. It was not allowed to run any commercial traffic over that. Now, at the end of 1991, and the announcement that piqued my interest was that commercial traffic ban was lifted, which now meant that this internet thing, which I knew was already connecting universities in Europe, and, you know, there was a certain amount of infrastructure there, but it was now fair game for doing something else. So I revisited then the internet protocols and TCP/IP and everything else, and just, it was my voila moment, like, here it is, here is the certainly from a protocol point of view, because it was designed for providing services, and that it was designed for a global network that was nonpartisan, if you like. And it was also intriguing from the point of view of that a lot of the people, while it was funded by the, you know, quasi-military kind of U.S. government, the people that were actually running it and building it out were actually quite alternative in their views, more from the 60s generation than the previous generation. And it was very much about empowerment and freedom and you know, the revolution. And I was a big believer in revolution. I think that if, you know, if something exists, it probably needs to be broken down and re-examined. And so as I delved deeper into the internet side of things, I decided, right, that this, by its nature, it will take off. I had that leap of faith that I said, this is the infrastructure that will replace all others, and that it wasn't owned by anybody. This the internet, particularly in the first couple of years, was a network that was built on top of telco networks, the telephone companies, they really didn't know anything about it. They didn't understand it. They didn't control it. They didn't even know it existed. It was literally, the internet was built by, you know, the likes of me getting a lease line from Aircom and then running something over it that they knew nothing about, and that we were using the legs of their connectivity to create this mesh around the world that, you know, a surprisingly small number of us were building out. I mean, at this stage, you know, I remember saying to my wife at the time that I find this incredible that there are only like a couple of dozen people in the world who even understand that this is happening. And, you know, it really felt like this, I couldn't believe it, right? I thought, there's no way that nobody else is going to see this, you know, and there's no, surely somebody else must be doing this. And I kept looking around, nobody was doing it. So I just was like, right, well, I'm gonna do this. And so it kind of took it from there. And, you know, I had no money from when we lived in London. I still had a NatWest credit card that had a 10,000 credit limit on it. And so I said, right, that 10,000 is, I'm going to light a fire under my arse. And before this runs out, I'm going to make a business of this. So I used 10,000 over the next 6 months or so, writing the business plan and running the BBS both as a way for me to test out ideas and also to have something to show somebody, because, you know, it's a bit like describing a spiral staircase without moving your hands. You know, to explain to somebody in 1992 that this internet thing was going to take over the world and create opportunities that and risks and threats, you know, to incumbent companies, the likes of which hasn't been seen in generations. You just get glass eyes and nobody would understand. So having the, what I called Galway Online, BBS.
What's BBS, just for?
A bulletin board system. It's really just, it was like a messaging exchange, and you could.
Like an intranet almost.
It was
like
a bit, yeah. No, it was a public thing.
Okay.
So people, you'd publish your phone numbers and people would dial in with a modem.
Gotcha.
And then it wasn't graphical, but it had like colored screens.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so it's an early boards.ie kind of a.
It was more the boards, though, because yeah. You know, you could play games and you could download files.
Okay.
And you know, shareware at that stage was a big thing. So there was a vibrant community would build up, and you know, you had some that were specialist in one particular area. There's a very famous one run out of Waterford that was all about hacking skyboxes. Or Sky Signals, I don't know, the cards or whatever. And it was world famous. People used to dial in to there from all over the world.
Gotcha.
To, you know, to get the latest codes or do whatever. So the BBS was a precursor to the likes of AOL and that type of thing. And so having decided that this is going to happen and I'm going to make it happen, I had to convince people that it was real, convince them to part with money to help fund it. And over a slow process, I did that before my 10,000 credit cards ran dry and NatWest started phoning me, wondering what was happening. I had gotten a further 20,000 investment in. And that enabled me to go to the next stage, which was to get a connection to the internet, which I got through Trinity College. And so then, for the first time, consumer subscribers could dial up, and they could, for a while, they chose when they logged in whether they wanted to see the BBS, which was the old system, or whether they wanted to get on the internet. And the internet consisted of, you know, links. The World Wide Web wasn't there. It was there was a protocol called Gopher, which was used by a lot of libraries and that type of thing. And Tim O'Reilly from O'Reilly Media, a great book publisher who's whose manuals I had devoured in my day. He set up a very early thing called the Global News Network. And I got in touch with Tim and said, can I mirror that over in Ireland? Because if I had, you know, bandwidth was incredibly expensive. And so I could, if I could copy over every morning his edition over onto my own servers, then my users could read it all day long and it wouldn't actually cost me every time they drag something across the Atlantic on a very slow link. And so we had that for a while and trying to build up content and so I say we, sorry, it was still me at this stage.
So just to frame that, so you were the original publisher, digital publisher, doing that type of work.
I'm kind of the original a lot of things. I mean, I'm employee number one in the internet industry because there was nobody else. I mean, the guys in Trinity, they were full-time lecturers.
Yeah.
Right. I was the only one, you know, the analogy about bacon and eggs for breakfast, you know, I was the pig. I was committed. I was the first web developer, which is, first digital marketeer.
Yeah,
just because they didn't exist. I wasn't very good at a lot of them,
But it's amazing because you talk about trying to convince people now, you know, even the telcos.
Yeah.
I mean, 5 years ago, if you're told a telco about WhatsApp, they were looking at you with glazed over eyes, you know, so it's not... Those challenges are still there. You just happen to be, you know, doing this before there was any context at all.
No context. That was the killer.
That is the killer. You know, there's the Greek myth of Cassandra, going back to your classics, and her curse was trying to tell people the future, but nobody ever believed her, and she knew the future, and you were Cassandra of Ireland, you know, 1992. I can just imagine, because it's frustrating for a lot of innovators to tell people what's coming. They can see it, because innovators can see this, and they can join the dots.
No, there's
no
doubt in my mind. I mean, I may have been headstrong and overconfident, but I knew exactly what this was going to do. And how it was going to spin out. You know, so much of, I mean, things like digital music and the distance education, all that, they're actually business plans that I wrote at the same time that I was doing the IOL.
Because you could just see the disruption that this would bring to every industry.
Yeah, because at the time, like, you know, I was convinced somebody else is going to do this. So I thought, I can't put all my eggs in one basket. This is back in 91 when I was, you know, doing. So I actually took three things and wrote three parallel business plans. And one of them was IOL. And the other ones were things that an IOL had to exist for them to work, right?
Yeah.
The idea being that, you know, if IOL gained traction and it actually succeeded, well and good, that's grand. But if it didn't, if somebody else came along, as I was convinced that, you know, people couldn't be this blind, they must see it, like that somebody's going to come with a lot of money and they're going to do the IOL thing. In that case, I had these two other ones in my back pocket, which would leverage the thing, because, it, you know, connecting people hadn't ever really been my primary thing. I actually wanted to live in the world where it existed, but it didn't exist, so I had to make it. I would have been quite happy and possibly happier had somebody else come along and done it and freed me to do the more interesting bits, because, you know, the ISP business, it's if it's done right, it's a very boring business and is best run by accountants. Whereas, you know, I like the creative bit, but the canvas, which is the internet, needs to exist for you to be able to do that thing. And it's, you know,
just to draw an analogy, I was just thinking there, like Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the telephone. Same thing. I mean, it's a network effect. Same thing.
Yeah.
The more people have a telephone, the better for those who have a telephone.
It's a network that's built from the ends, you know, by the consumers of the network, which is a fascinating thing. It's unlike most other networks where it's, you know, it's built at a point and pushed out, whereas the internet is a pull thing.
Yeah, but the beautiful thing about Alexander Graham Bell was he tried to sell it early to AT&T, who turned him down. and that we know how that turned out. Yeah. Same, you know, you look at so many of these. Google tried to sell to Yahoo. Yahoo weren't interested. I mean, so you're this is a curse of the innovator, the early pioneer.
Timing has never been my
yeah, because you were so far ahead of the game.
Yeah, far too far. I mean, if I had been 2 years later, I could have still been the first, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
Without all the pain of the first 2 years, but you know, at the same time, those first 2 years, I learned what I was doing. You know, because I was literally,
and that's like, the only way you got your hands dirty. Like what you like to do your whole life, getting your hands dirty to understand the mechanics.
So you know, by the time 1994, 95 came, I knew what I was doing, and in fact, the new entrants didn't have that experience, even though they might have had qualifications, and you know, because nobody had actually done this bit before. And so by that stage, I had 2 years behind me, which was, in retrospect, a good thing. But definitely, I was 2 years early.
Yeah, yeah.
If I had a commercial mind, I would have waited.
But it's a funny one, because it's one you see quite often, Barry, where you see, you know, the passion of an innovator is actually in the product, what I'm doing, and the money will come.
Yeah.
You know, so often you see these pairings like Jobs and Wozniak, you know, these kind of beautiful
the
pairings.
The two, well, I got my Jobs in Colm Greely.
Yeah, so Colm came along. When did Colm come along?
In about 1994. So I had been making very good headway with the service, you know, in terms of the limited market that was there. I think I had, you know, maybe 1,000 customers on. And I had modems in Galway and Dublin at that stage. And we had, this is again still pre-World Wide Web, I had licensed a piece of software from a crowd in New York who had basically put it was written in Visual Basic, but, you know, for Windows, but it put somebody described it once as that it put a tap onto the pipe, right? The pipe being the internet, and that this, you know, gave a user a graphical click, you know, click here for email, click here for information services or whatever, you know, again, using Gopher on the back end and all those things. And that really, it moved it from being a really, really nerds only text-based service to being, my granny could use this, you know, and we could distribute it on a single floppy disk and all the rest of it. And my initial investor, who gave me the initial 20,000, was a man called Michael Greely. He had worked with Digital Equipment and later was the HR director with Aer Lingus, and very savvy and smart guy. But he came, and we were just having a review. This was in I guess summer 1994, and I showed him through the system, the new software, and he said, Barry, this is, you've built an amazing system here. He said, we really need to get this pushed out into the market. Now we still had no money, and so Michael says, he says, look, he's my brother Colm. He's a school teacher, but he's really into technology. He's, you know, he's got a PC and he does all games and all that stuff. But more importantly, he could sell ice to Eskimos. Would you be interested in meeting him and see, you know, like if you think that he could do some good? And I said, definitely, great. So arranged a meeting, went down to the Ashland Hotel just by Houston Station and met up with him. Immediately we hit it off. Like he, you know, I showed him the thing and all the rest, and he immediately got it, the potential of it and stuff. And because he was a teacher, he was off for the summer, which meant that he had free time and he wasn't risking anything. And that because he already had a full-time wage, we didn't have to pay him. He got, you know, paid on what he sold. So he started up, and immediately then that changed everything, because now I had somebody who really did have a drive and a commercial and market sense, if you like, of how to move it from where it was to where it could be. And so over the next probably 6 months or so, Colm would... he was based in Dublin, which was good because Dublin was obviously the market. You know, my idealistic stake in the ground in Galway was becoming more and more tenuous as reality bit. And, you know, the market actually is in Dublin, not Galway. And so Colm used to change in the school toilets into a suit. And on the way home from school, then he'd head off and do a few sales calls and whatever. And literally, you know, this was selling the internet one subscription at a time and delivering it to your door and installing it, you know, with the modem and all the rest of it. You know, we got a lot of great customers, the early customers. And Colm has said, and it's true, that, you know, the first 2,000 customers of IOL, we probably knew them by name. And then I had always done the kind of the trade shows, but around 1995, the trade shows used to be Frank Quinn and Mark Egan from Computerscope. They used to run Windows World and different big, you know, tech conferences of the day in the RDS. And they were very, very good to me in terms of giving me free space, you know, when I needed it. And then double the space when I could afford to pay for something. And eventually it paid them back, because everybody, like, you know, we used to have the people 20 deep. Our stand in the RDS was just chock-a-block with people, with Colm up there doing his sending an email to the White House routine, you know, because if you sent him an email to president@whitehouse.gov, you immediately got a reply back, you know, just from an autoresponder. So it was Colm's little trick, and people were always amazed. It's like, wow, that went all the way over to Washington, D.C. and back again, you know. And
of,
like,
course, because there's no context again. There was no context.
No.
You had to. It was snail mail. It was actually post.
Yeah. So that's when, you know, it gradually started to build up. And then, you know, Colm, of course, came on full time pretty quickly. And
what year was this then, Barry?
They were in 95. It was probably the end of 94 that he came on full time.
I think I was on Duke Nukem then. The
right. Yeah.
So thank you for that. The old. I was just thinking about the evolution, and, you know, you talked about the Spectrum 64. There was nothing worse than when you put your cassette in and you went through all the noise.
And then it was like,
and then it didn't load. Yeah. And then you had to do it again.
Because the tapes used to stretch and stuff as well.
Over, yeah. You know, and then you have to, and there was no rewind. So you had to turn the tape around, fast forward to rewind the other side. But then, and then these days it was dial up. So the dial up world where you had to connect, make a phone call essentially to connect.
Yeah.
So 95 we're at this stage.
Yeah. And that's about when, late 95, when you're talking about telecoms operators and how, you know, they don't see things. I can tell you from experience, they don't see things until it affects 10% of their
business.
Their business.
That's the same in everywhere,
and
isn't
then
it?
It's like, what is this? Then how do we get ahead?
So the iceberg is coming. You know, and you're like, that iceberg has been in your vision for 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't...
They're looking in the wrong place, you see.
Until it hits your hull.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's amazing. And it's in so many companies that they can see that iceberg and they do not do anything about the iceberg until it affects the bottom line.
Mm. So I got a call one day, still based out in Furbo in Galway, from the regional manager of Telecom Éireann at the time. And he asked to meet me for lunch. And I said, that's fine. So went and met him. And he shook my hand and said, thank you very much for meeting. Thank you very much. And I'm like a little bit confused as to why he wants to see me, you know, but never would refuse a call from any. Maybe they wanted to put money in. Maybe they suddenly had, you know, an epiphany and decided they'd want to help me. But anyway, he says, yeah, the reason I wanted to meet you, and he reaches in to his briefcase and pulls out a spreadsheet. He says, this is the top revenue generating numbers in Ireland. And he says, the top one here is director inquiries. And so this next one is one of your numbers. And it's generating 12% of our call revenue, right? What is it you guys do exactly?
Wow.
Yeah. And I said, well, you know, it's the internet. And
yeah.
He says, yeah, what's that? And I said, well, I'll tell you what. He says, well, what can we do to help you? And I said, well, funny, there's actually a lot you could do to help me. Wow. How about you arrange a meeting and we'll come down and talk about the ways you could help? And he says, yeah, okay. So
I was just thinking the irony as well of number two on the list is going to eat number one very soon as well. Mm-hmm. Directory inquiries.
Yeah, who does directory inquiries anymore? So we duly went down and they were amazed that you could do this over a phone line, because we just went into the Stevens Green headquarters and there were a bunch of guys sitting around the boardroom. And I said, look, it's probably easier if I just, rather than trying to explain what we do, I'll just show you. Do you have a phone line? And they all look at one another and kind of laugh. You know, yeah, we're Aircom. Of course we got a phone line, or Telecom Air. So I plugged my little laptop in and loaded up. By this stage, it was World Wide Web. You know, we had Netscape. And was able to just went and cruised around the web, and they couldn't believe it. They're like, you're doing this over a phone line. You know, it's not even ISDN or anything. No, it's your phone line. So anyway, we had a subsequent conversation about how, you know, they could build out a network that would service all of this. They could have local dial-up in throughout the country, and that they pay us a cut of the revenue for the calls that we generate. And they're like, yeah, if we did that for you, we'd have to do it for everybody. And we said, great, yeah, do it for everybody. You know, that would take... building out a network is very expensive. You know, when you're... Like, our business was growing 10% a month for probably throughout 94 to 97, which is a huge... You know, in every... You have to have the modems in place before you... the users can connect, you know, so you're having to invest ahead of the growth, which makes it a very capital intensive, accountant driven business, which ultimately is why Aircom decided no, they didn't want to help us and help the country, that they'd rather set up their own to compete against us. So that's what they did, monumentally unsuccessfully for the first 5 years, which was gratifying. And eventually we made a similar type of deal with OnPost, or OnPost's subsidiary PostGem, which ran the actual network between all of the post offices. So they had modems in all the post offices around the country. And they provided us with a national network that we paid for as we used, literally, you know, per modem per month kind of thing. And that enabled us to stay ahead of the curve and also get very heavily in debt to OnPost, which ultimately resulted in them buying the company.
So how did it all conclude, Barry? How did IOL?
Well, unfortunately, at the time in the 90s, there was no venture capital.
You ran out of runway, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, in total, we had raised... £150,000. That was the entire...
Which was nothing for what you've done.
What we achieved.
Amazing.
What we achieved was out of sheer graft and cash flow. Mm. And, you know, it's the tough way to grow a business.
And just to, again, like, just to tip the cap to you, you did this with a family. You did this with...
Yeah, well, we all had
which
families,
is amazing. Yeah. Like, and Colm as well.
Colm
amazing.
As well.
Like, because, you know, you see so many startups now and they're funded to the hilt and they're doing this before they have the golden handcuffs of the family, the mortgage, and as you said earlier on, just that responsibility to mind another human being, you know, so... You know, to do that is just—it's such an amazing legacy. And I really wanted to get you on the show to record this, to put it out onto the platform that you built. So it's there. But it's there as a legacy.
It'll never last, though.
Somebody will tear
it down. Bit rot and stuff.
Yeah. I will put it out there. I'll give you a copy and we'll load it up to many clouds.
It's like Vince Cerf says, you have to start carving stuff into stone again if you want it to last.
Exactly, yeah, it's amazing. But so let's get to the finale, the grand finale. So what happened?
Having tried, we spent between, 94, 95 and most of 96 looking for investment and all the rest. Not huge investment, hundreds of thousands. And it simply wasn't forthcoming. People still thought the internet's a skateboard craze, it's going to disappear and all the rest. Or they just were too scared by the lack of knowledge. We spent a long time educating VCs, and the VC scene was very new here. And at the end of the day, then there was only one option that was Unpulse. But again, because of my belief that, IOL had to exist, it was a bit like a daughter, marrying and going off. But at the same time, what I had set out to achieve was, to me, it was done. I had done it. I had proved that even taking the hard way in my own education and taking the hard way in terms of perceived wisdom, that I had proven myself to myself and, created an industry along the way.
Yeah. No, it's it's amazing, Barry. And thank you for coming into us. And this has been our first special, hour-long special. So thank you for coming in. Barry Flanagan, founder of Ireland Online, who put us all online in this fair isle. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Aidan.